Here comes Indie Week. Our current issue, dated June the 10th, 2020, is read today by John Federson for our blind and print-impaired listeners. Today's musicians are up from Fort Mudge. They are the Okefenokee Swamp, Glee, Purlieu, and Marching Society Band, and they'll be back in an hour or so. And we'll move right into our opening column, Voices, this one by Courtney Napier, a Raleigh Native community activist and co-host of the podcast Mothering on the Margins. The system has failed us. When I think about George Floyd, Tony McDade, Breonna Taylor, and countless other black people murdered by police, I don't see one guilty party, but a failed system built to uphold the myth of white supremacy. Derek Chauvin, the Minneapolis cop who killed George Floyd, had more than a dozen complaints against him. At least two were nearly lethal, with one person saying he busted down a bathroom door and began beating him without provocation. In fact, the entire Minneapolis Police Department was investigated by the Department of Justice in 2015. The DOJ uncovered systemic failures and, quote, provided recommendations for needed improvements in police accountability. The MPD failed to follow many of these recommendations and failed to keep cops like Chauvin off the street. The issue is simple. A police department cannot be in charge of policing itself. But a police department isn't supposed to make those decisions, not in Minneapolis and not here. It is one agency of a local government under the authority of, in Raleigh's case, the city manager. Police Chief Cassandra Deck Brown's boss is Ruffin Hall, whose boss is Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin. The latter two would have you believe that they are powerless to call for more accountability from the Raleigh Police Department. As Raleigh PACT and other activist groups have advocated for an oversight board, the first line to come out of City Hall is, only the General Assembly can create that sort of policy. That's debatable. According to Dawn Blagrove, attorney and executive director of Emancipate NC, Governor Cooper could grant police oversight board's subpoena and investigatory power by executive order. She also told the State of Things that the city council determines who is the custodian of personnel files and that there's, quote, a provision inside the North Carolina law that says that the city employee can put a waiver in their personnel file that says the community can have access to it. It's important then to ask why those solutions have not been pursued. James Baldwin gives us a hint in a 1966 essay for The Nation titled A Report from Occupied Territory. The police are simply the hired enemies of this population, is the quote. They are present to keep the Negro in his place and to protect white business interests, and they have no other function. If Mayor Baldwin has been clear about one thing, is that she prizes Raleigh's business owners, especially downtown. Capitalism requires an eager police force that targets marginalized people. Data on the RPD's traffic stops suggests that this is exactly what they have. A year after Dick Brown and Hall took their positions in 2013, the percentage of searches during the traffic stops involving black people decreased to 60%. By 2019, however, they'd reached a 20-year high of 77%, and 92% of drivers on whom police used force last year were black. There should have been mayhem the day that Hall blocked city council members from viewing the police accountability recommendations drafted by the Human Relations Commission in May of 2019. Currently, there are five vacancies on the HRC, but instead of filling those seats, Baldwin has asked for a staff for a report on the HRC's effectiveness. Nearly everyone who participated at the special city council meeting on the protest last Thursday called for Dick Brown's resignation, and many also called for Baldwin's resignation. But not a single person called for Hall to be fired. In Raleigh, the city manager runs daily operations, so both Baldwin and Hall allowed Dick Brown's police force to tear gas and harass peaceful protesters last week. And if Dick Brown were fired, the city manager would appoint her successor. All of this reveals the city's real mandate to the RPD: protect business interests by any means necessary. But this doesn't apply only to the RPD. Every layer of our municipal government is dedicated to this guiding principle. The police watch the purse, and City Hall watches their back. When they oppress, and eventually push out, the black and the poor, Raleigh's developers reap the economic benefit. The city then keeps the public's calls for justice at bay and increases the police budget with the spoils. We cannot, in good conscience or logic, call for the resignation of Deck Brown and Mayor Baldwin without also calling for the resignation of Ruffin Hall. We must learn from the deadly miscarriage of justice that occurred in Minneapolis and in our own city's recent history. The system has failed us. It's time to clean house. Moving to the new column, The Good, the Bad, and the Awful. The good, the North Carolina Supreme Court. It's asinine that we're still fighting over this, but here we are. 14 years after North Carolina last executed a person, the state Supreme Court dealt what should be a death blow to the antiquated notion of capital punishment in this state. In a pair of 6-1 decisions on Friday, the court ruled the Racial Justice Act, which the General Assembly repealed in 2013, cannot be applied retroactively. In effect, this means that the majority of the 143 people on death row will get a chance to appeal their sentences on racial grounds. Since we know North Carolina prosecutors were long taught how to circumvent U.S. Supreme Court strictures prohibiting racial discrimination in jury selection, there's a good chance many of these appeals will prove fruitful. As Chief Justice Sherry Beasley admitted last week, systemic racism is infused into every part of the criminal justice system. But let's take a longer view. Since we stopped executing people, the state's murder and violent crime rates haven't gone up. So we can surmise that the death penalty didn't work as a deterrent. With the majority of people on death row being black, we can also surmise that race is at least a factor in how people are sentenced. So what's the point in even trying to keep this system going? And the bad award goes to the Republican National Committee. Yes, negotiations over the Republican National Convention in Charlotte were running smoothly until President Trump interjected himself on Twitter, accusing Governor Cooper of playing politics with the COVID-19 crisis to deny the president a rapturous packed house for his acceptance speech. And yes, once the president butted in, there was little they could do but follow. Still, the degree of bad faith the RNC has displayed over the last few weeks, leading to Cooper telling them he wouldn't budget and the GOP saying they'd take their convention elsewhere last week, has been astounding. The party never submitted a safety plan for the state to review, never came up with viable alternatives short of cram them in, see what happens, maybe we'll have some hand sanitizer around. Then they put on a world-class pout when Cooper said that wasn't good enough. Have fun in Jacksonville, or wherever. And the awful. The Capitol's Constellation Prizes. In the last week, as the Floyd protests spread across the country, Jacksonville, the most conservative large city in the U.S., removed a Confederate monument from a city park. Authorities removed Confederate monuments in Birmingham and Mobile, Alabama, too. Fredericksburg, Virginia, removed a 176-old slave auction block from its downtown. The United Daughters of the Confederacy had the good sense to remove their statue from Old Town in Alexandria. The state of Virginia was about to remove a statue of Robert E. Lee in Richmond, the home of the Confederacy, before a judge issued a temporary restraining order. That didn't save a statue of another Confederate general. Protesters toppled him themselves. And yet, the Confederate monuments on North Carolina's Capitol grounds remain, guarded against protesters by law enforcement, protected from removal by a state law enacted after a white supremacist gunned down 9 people in a black church, and people everywhere began to reevaluate the wisdom of honoring a Confederacy born in the blood of enslaved people. and a short column, the 15 minutes column, this time Andrea Muffin Hudson, age 47. She's the director of the North Carolina Community Bail Fund of Durham. Sarah Edwards writes this question and answer. You've had a personal experience with the cash bail system, right? Yeah, I couldn't afford my bail, so I sat in jail for 2 months. Then my charges got dismissed. And in those 2 months, I lost my housing and I lost my job. And I couldn't find a job because of the charges. And even though they were dismissed, they still showed up on my background. What are the types of low-level offenses that people are typically incarcerated for? Normally, it's for breaking and entering. A lot, all of the folks that I have seen and bailed out for this charge are homeless folks who have gone into a business and fell asleep under a table or under a chair. They didn't steal anything, they were just in there sleeping. A lot of trespassing charges and some domestic charges too, like simple assault. But because we've raised so much money, we've raised the amount from $2,000 to $5,000. So now we're able to get more people out since the cap is higher. How many people have you worked with? Since 2017, I'm going to say it's 100 people. And out of the 100 people, 22 have been since March. We bailed out more people since March than we have the whole year of 2019 because we didn't have the funds in 2019. Once COVID hit, people felt an urgency to go ahead and donate. The narrative should be that people may be accused of a crime, but their crimes don't warrant a death sentence. They have said that people have gotten better from COVID, right? But people have also died from COVID. And the folks that are more likely to die for it are people incarcerated and in jail because they're not going to get the proper medical attention that they need. Speaking from experience from when I was in the Durham County Jail, even though Clarence Burkhead wasn't the sheriff at the time, my head got to hurting so bad I was afraid I was going to have a stroke because my mother had a stroke and died from a stroke. I kept ringing the bell, but the detention officer cut the phone off so they wouldn't hear it. They never came over. How has COVID-19 increased the urgency of getting people out of prison? It's very important to get people out of pretrial detention and out of prisons because they don't have the means to practice social distancing. If we're on the outside and we can't find the cleaning supplies to keep our places sanitary, how are they going to get the supplies? They're not. We can't get them. Finally, you've been doing rolling protests past the jail during the pandemic. How do these work? People stay in the car. That way people won't be afraid to come out, worrying about whether or not they're going to be in contact with too many people because they stay in a car. The very first time we had like 30 cars, then the next week we had 11, then 5, so it fluctuates. I put my number out because there's a number that people can call about bail, and it's free for them, and people called. And they said that the rolling protests were the highlight of their week. They can't wait till they hear the horns because they know that those horns are out there for them, and they haven't been forgotten. And now, from Jeffrey C. Billman in Soapboxer column, the F word. Despite the recent proliferation of memes, the early 20th century novelist Sinclair Lewis probably never said, "When fascism comes to America, it will be wrapped in the flag and carrying a cross." But he would have endorsed the sentiment. Watching Hitler's rise to power in Europe while the anti-Semitic Father Charles Coughlin and the swaggering dictatorial populist Louisiana Senator Huey the Kingfish Long ascended in the United States, Lewis cobbled together a dystopian near future for his novel, It Can't Happen Here, which envisioned a kingfish-like politician winning the presidency on promises to lift up the forgotten man, the white working class, and installing a totalitarian regime wrapped in Americana, including a Gestapo-type force called the Minutemen. Before Lewis's antagonist, Buzz Windrip, took office, liberals fretted about his autocratic tendencies, but their concerns were deemed alarmist. A fascist dictatorship couldn't happen in America. That was a pervading sensibility in the mid-30s. In October 1935, the month Lewis's novel was published, the newspaperman William Randolph Hearst brushed aside anxieties about creeping fascism. That word, he argued, was merely a pejorative aimed at patriots. Quote, whenever you hear a prominent American called a fascist, you can usually make up your mind that the man is simply a loyal citizen who stands for Americanism. It Can't Happen Here, which quickly became a bestseller, was a warning about that complacency. What Lewis understood was that there's nothing magical about the Constitution. The document itself has no power. It binds us only so long as we agree to its tenets, that there should be three separate but equal branches of government, that there should be freedom of speech, religion, and press, that all people are guaranteed equal rights under the law, and so on. Our democracy is undergirded by norms more fragile than we'd like to think. 81 years and 1 month after its debut, It Can't Happen Here became popular again as Lewis's warning resonated across time. Within a week of Donald Trump's election, the book sold out on Amazon. There were significant differences between the fictional Winthrop and the stranger-than-fiction president-elect. Winthrop was a quasi-socialist, for starters. But there were more than a few similarities, too. Winthrop reveled in big rallies. He had a propaganda machine that invented its own reality. He made direct appeals to racial animus, and liberals fretted before the election about his illiberal tendencies, only to see their concerns dismissed as alarmist. Upon taking office, Trump didn't immediately imprison dissenters or dissolve states or label Congress advisory, as Winthrop did, but he's blustered like an authoritarian. He's shown an affinity for autocrats. He's expansively wielded executive power, like when he diverted military funds to a border wall under the guise of a national emergency. And over the last 3.5 years, the guardrails of democracy have been slowly eroded, rather than eviscerated, like the proverbial frog in boiling water. Amid the constant chaos of the Trump administration, the Mueller probe, the Twitter bellicosity, the impeachment, we became inured to these encroachments on the rule of law and numb to statements and deeds that would have generated weeks of outrage in any prior administration but barely register now. Throughout history, political scientists Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt have written, authoritarians try to do three things: capture the referees, sideline key players, and change the rules. Trump has done all three. He's tried to capture the referees by purging his administration of the disloyal, most recently inspectors general who conducted unfavorable investigation. He sought to sideline key players by intimidating the media, and he's tried to change the rules by claiming that efforts to expand voter access are fraudulent and having Attorney General William Barr game the justice system for his allies. But two recent events have put this squarely into focus. The first came on May 28th when Trump signed an executive order targeting social media platforms because one of them dared to, meekly, fact-check one of his false statements. Sideline key players? Check. Change the rules? Check. 2 days earlier, Twitter had appended a note to two tweets directing people to accurate information about voting by mail. The next day, the U.S. eclipsed 100,000 COVID deaths, an event the president marked by promising an executive order reigning in Twitter for its offense. The order, likely unconstitutional, seeks to treat social media platforms that regulate speech in any way as publishers rather than content hosts, making them liable for whatever their users post. Ironically, under that standard, Twitter would likely ban the president. This is, in short, the president using the federal government to coerce private companies into helping him spread propaganda and disinformation. The second, of course, is when Barr had federal agents use pepper spray and rubber bullets to clear legally assembled peaceful protesters out of Lafayette Square in Washington, D.C., so that the president could stage a photo op with a Bible in front of a boarded-up church. Thus, just after he pledged to sic the U.S. military on unruly citizens because he is, quote, your president of law and order. It's that last scene that brought out the Sinclair Lewis memes. Perhaps it's too much to call it fascism, even cloaked in pseudo-patriotism and holding a Bible aloft. But it doesn't feel like a healthy democracy either. To our regional coverage now, Jake Sheridan's column from Durham, The Color of COVID. The story was produced through a partnership between Indy and the Ninth Street Journal, which is published by journalism students at Duke University's DeWitt Wallace Center for Media and Democracy. Black and Latinx people in Durham have tested positive for COVID-19 at rates that far outsize their populations, according to new data from the County Health Department. Latinx people account for 14% of county residents and 34% of its COVID-19 cases as of May 25th. Black people, who make up 37% of the population, account for 42% of confirmed cases. White people, meanwhile, total 54% of residents, but just 26% of cases. The unequal infection rate is linked to where people work or are confined, the data show. Nursing care facilities, correctional facilities, and construction sites were the most common settings linked to positive diagnoses. In Durham, Black and Latinx people make up a majority of workers and residents who have tested positive in each of those settings. Black people make up 67% of the cases associated with nursing care facilities and 53% of the cases associated with correctional facilities. Some of Durham's largest outbreaks have occurred in these facilities. At the Durham Nursing and Rehabilitation Center, at least 111 people were diagnosed with COVID-19, and the Butner Federal Correctional Complex, which is partly located in Durham County, at least 424 inmates have tested positive. Latinx people make up 91% of the cases associated with construction work, according to the Department of Public Health. Outdoor construction has been exempted from Durham's aggressive stay-at-home order. The overrepresentation of minorities among people diagnosed with the illness has emerged and increased since the novel coronavirus first reached the Bull City. The fact that Durham's racial minorities are disproportionately affected doesn't surprise Del Monte Jefferson, executive director of NAATPN, a Durham-based organization that advocates for the health of black people nationally. Jefferson says, "In Durham, just like other places across the country, and most of your service industry workers, those that are on the front line that have been deemed essential are people of color. These are the folks that have to go into work every day. And so if they have to go into work every day, that means they're front-facing and they're exposed to this virus." Pilar Rocha Goldberg, CEO and president of El Centro Hispano, sees the coronavirus exacerbating pre-existing health disparities. "We had gaps before," Rocha Goldberg says. "A lot of them don't have a primary doctor to go to if they feel sick or lack knowing how to navigate the system." El Centro Hispano, which supports the education, health, and economic well-being of Latinx communities in the Triangle, is sharing educational resources on COVID-19 with community members, but some people who might be sick are afraid to get treated. "People always fear giving information because of their immigration status," Rocha Goldberg says. "During this outbreak, they worry that using public services could lead to their deportation," she adds. Reports during the early phase of the outbreak misled some people in the community into thinking they wouldn't be affected because they are Latinx, she says. "White people were overrepresented among positive tests in Durham at the onset of the virus, 58% of the cases in March. As testing had become more available and the virus spread, however, white people accounted for an increasingly smaller share of cases, 27% in April, 16% in May. Meanwhile, the rate of diagnosis among people of color skyrocketed. In March, Latinx people accounted for 7% and black made up 25%. In April, black people amounted for 57% of new cases. And in May, Latinx people accounted for 58% of new cases. After obtaining data on the diagnoses among racial and ethnic groups in Durham, the Ninth Street Journal asked the County Health Department for additional data involving COVID-19 deaths and testing access, as well as that information about the origins of the disparity and what the county is doing to address it. the department did not respond. According to the State Department of Health and Human Services, black people make up 34% of reported COVID deaths across the state, but only 23% of the state's population. Latinx people have been slightly underrepresented in deaths statewide. Now, the state's racial and ethnic fatality data are incomplete. Racial identification is missing in 5% of cases, and ethnic identification is missing in 16%. Durham's racial and ethnic data is similarly incomplete. Jefferson feels the broad impact of the coronavirus will haunt the health and economic well-being of communities of color for decades. He says, "We're looking at least 20 to 30 years before our communities can start to recover. That's going to devastate our communities." He worries, too, that protests ignited by the police killing of George Floyd will amplify the damage COVID-19 causes in black communities by increasing the spread of the disease. "Yes, we're mad," Jefferson says. "Yes, we're hurt. Yes, we want justice. But we really can't be distracted. We've got to continue practicing social distancing." And over to Tomasi McDonald and Lee Taus from News from Raleigh, called Intimidation Move. The RPD's push to arrest an activist in the dead of night draws calls for the police chief's resignation. Revelations that the Raleigh Police Department facilitated the late-night arrest of a 27-year-old activist is fueling distrust of law enforcement and calls for the resignations of Police Chief Cassandra Deck Brown and Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin. As the Indy first reported last week, at 2:15 a.m. on Friday, Wake County Sheriff's deputies arrested Conrad James at his mother's house in Willow Springs on charges of failing to return and damaging a rental car. The sheriff's office made the late-night arrest at the request of the RPD, although the RPD had nothing to do with the alleged crime and no jurisdiction over Willow Spring. Instead, the RPD says it sought the sheriff's office assistance following a background check on James and discovered active arrest warrants after he made a nuisance of himself on Wednesday afternoon when he was caught on TV news cameras banging on windows at the department's North District headquarters. In addition, hours before his arrest, he publicly threatened to lodge a class action lawsuit against the city over the police department's use of tear gas against protesters. The question remains, why was it necessary to haul James in the dead of night in his pajamas for a nonviolent offense? From the start, law enforcement agencies have given contradictory accounts of how that arrest went down. RPD spokesman Donna Maria Harris initially said the agency was not involved. Then, after being told that the sheriff's office had said the RPD had asked deputies to pick up James, said she had given her initial statement without all the facts. Asked who first told her that the RPD wasn't involved, Harris said she had misheard. She also said the agency did not ask the sheriff's office to arrest James at a particular time. But Eric Curry, a spokesman for the Wake County Sheriff's Office, said the WCSO received the request at 12:30 a.m. Friday, about 3 hours after James announced his intent to sue, asking that James, quote, be picked up shortly after we received the request, Curry told the Indy on Sunday. According to jail reports, deputies arrested him at 2:15. The charge of failing to return a rental car is a Class H felony. The property damage charge is a misdemeanor. Fuquay Varina Police Department had filed the charges 2 weeks ago on May 22nd. The day before, a branch manager with Enterprise reported that James had not returned a 2020 Nissan Versa on April the 21st. According to a police report, after the manager made several attempts to reach James, James contacted Enterprise and said he had lost the keys in Alabama and could not return the car. Susan Weiss, a spokesman for the town of Fuquay Varina, says the vehicle was found damaged in Cary. On Monday, James told the Indy he had reported the car stolen in Alabama. He was unable to produce a police report. Asked to provide an incident report number, James said it was on another phone, which was dead. He had previously told the Indy the car was returned to an auto mall in Apex. At the RPD office last Wednesday, James, quote, began creating a disturbance by banging on the doors and windows of the inner lobby and demanding to be let in, even though signage is clearly posted on the outer door that the district station is closed to the public due to COVID-19. Harris says, a desk officer informed James the station was closed and he should leave, but he continued to cause a commotion, Harris says. He insisted on giving Deck Brown a list of demands. When the officer asked James for the list, he said he needed to write them out, Harris said. According to Harris, James wrote the list and gave it to an officer, who then handed them to Deck Brown. She walked outside to meet him moments after he was pushed out the door. They spoke briefly. His exchange was captured by WRAL. Harris says police learned about the outstanding warrants for James during a debriefing late Wednesday night. We wanted to know, who is this guy? The police did not charge him with disorderly conduct on Wednesday, she says, out of sensitivity to the ongoing protests. Harris did not say when the RPD contacted the sheriff's office to request the arrest, only that the agency followed standard procedure. Curry checked the officer's logs and found a phone call at 12:30 a.m. Friday, more than 24 hours after Harris says the RPD discovered the warrants. Quote, he says, it appears the RPD request was made with some type of time parameter. We would not have any interest in picking up Mr. James. I can't speak for the police department, but there was no reason for the sheriff's office to pick up this gentleman in an expeditious time frame. This wasn't James's first run-in with the law, though his criminal record does not contain anything that suggests he poses a threat. Traffic, trespassing, drug paraphernalia, simple marijuana, and underage drinking convictions. He was wounded by a bullet at a friend's house in what police called a random drug dispute 2 years ago. Activist Kerwin Pittman believes the police came for James when they did to scare him. Pittman says, their purpose was most definitely intimidation because the man was visible at rallies. The tactic they used, you can tell it's intimidation tactics, which RPD and law enforcement used throughout the years against individuals who speak up. It's a shame you have law enforcement deploying these kinds of tactics, especially at this time when there's a spotlight on them and their misconduct. Baldwin says she has limited knowledge of the situation, though she admits, quote, the optics on that were bad. Addressing how James' arrest was handled will require examining police policy, Baldwin says. That's a task for the city's newly appointed police review board. The activists who for years have demanded a police oversight board are deeply unsatisfied with what they got. The body is by and large toothless. It lacks investigatory, subpoena, and disciplinary powers, and is reduced to merely reviewing police procedures. While the city points to a state law that says it limits what a civilian board can do, this is only furthered distrust. Akiba Bird, who co-founded Raleigh's Police Accountability Task Force in 2015, points out that the officer who shot 24-year-old Akil Dinkins in 2016 is still working in that community. That, Bird says, shows Deck Brown's insensitivity to the brown and black people living there. PACT, Police Accountability Task Force, has shown up in force at city council meetings following other recent incidents of police violence, the 2019 killing of Sohail Mojarrad, the January viral video of police beating a Raleigh man until his face was bloodied, the 2020 killings of Keith Dutry Collins and David Tylek Atkinson, the former carrying a BB gun, the latter after he allegedly robbed a gas station. When police investigate themselves, residents tend not to trust the results. The regularity of incidents involving the RPD serves as a routine reminder of how the department treats its black citizen, Pittman says, adding that there's not a black man in Raleigh who doesn't get nervous when a police car pulls up behind him. Pittman says, Raleigh PD, if they can find anything to kind of snag you on, they will, and they will do it, especially if you are someone who's becoming active or has been active. Worse, he says, Raleigh cops have a tendency to escalate things, pointing to a video that went viral this weekend of officers pulling guns on a man following a fender bender. PACT along with Raleigh Demands Justice, has given a list of demands to the City Council that, in addition to a list of reforms, includes the resignation of Deck Brown, who opposed any kind of oversight board. To PACT leader Rolanda Byrd, the mother of Akil Denkins, this is a sign that Deck Brown would rather keep her brothers in blue safe from accountability than protect the community. Rolanda Byrd said, "I think she needs to be fired. She is a coward. She is not looking for change or reform." Pittman adds, "The first step in admitting you have a problem in order for you to fix that problem, and she won't admit that RPD has a problem. She can't, and that's the reason she needs to go." The Raleigh City Council planned to appoint members to its Police Policy Review Board later this month. Baldwin says the council will be looking into implementing reforms outlined in the #8 can't wait campaign, including banning police from using chokeholds and shooting at moving vehicles. The council will also consider a 3 strikes rule for officers with records of misconduct. Baldwin has no plans to resign or call for Deck Brown to step down. And she adds, Deck Brown still has the council's support. "We have said as a council that we support the chief," Baldwin said. "She has 32 years of experience. She has always performed and acted very compassionately and professionally. She's an African-American who knows and understands what racism feels like. We support her, and we have her back." But here's what that means in North Carolina. All white caucuses repair to closed-door meetings to decide our laws. No persons of color are present to object. The all-white assemblies routinely propose laws that disadvantage and are strongly opposed by African Americans and other racial minorities, making it tougher for them to vote, to get effective representation, to hold on to elections already won, to get access to the courts, to be free from racially imposed sanctions, to enjoy an equal education, to escape police brutality. They regularly enact statutes that are invalidated by both state and federal courts as clear examples of intentional race discrimination. They occasionally admit they legislate to disadvantage black people, but they claim to do so because the black people are Democrats, not because they're black. And that's all the time we have. John Fetterson has been reading the Indie Week for our blind and print impaired listeners. It'll be available on our website after a podcast, after our initial broadcast. That website is ncreadingservice.org. We'll be back next week. So long for now.